with Skid Row Chatter and Tom Pitts. Guest for tonight is the magnificent J.R. Lansdale. Tom, take it away, my friend.
Thank you so much. We went down. I checked with our immediate listening audience, and most everything went out there, and everything's smooth. So we're just going to pick up where we left off, and we were discussing Beyond Your Fabulous Career, which I was turning a little green with envy. I did have, you know, before we leave the movie subject, which we were covering in the first half. I was curious. What can you tell us about the adaptation for The Bottoms? Is that something you adapted? It's being made.
No. Brent Hanley did the adaptation. He wrote the film Frailty for Bill Paxton to direct, and Bill Paxton actually stars in it, of course, and Matthew McConaughey's in it, Powers Booth. But Bill and Brent and I have been trying to get what we want. It's not that we don't have interest. We just don't have the interest we want in the way we want. But we're optimistic that we're going to get it out there. And so we're out there peddling our wares. The Bottoms is something that we're all deeply invested in. And we've got a great screenplay. And we're just hoping, and we've had the money. We just need the right person to say, I'm going to do this. The person that fits the role and the person who can actually, you know, get us a little attention.
Yeah, it's having grown up in Canada, where there's a similar legend of Goban that scared me as a kid, that whole sort of angle of the story that pulls you in is intrigued me greatly. And it's also it's a great sort of example of I don't know if you'd call it a crossover, but it has elements from different genres that kind of cross over and ends up being great.
What's funny about that thing is that, you know, I mainly heard it as a Southern story, and especially around, the Sabine River and stuff when I was growing up. But when that book came out, people wrote me from everywhere that they had the stories about the Goat Man, Illinois, all over, you know, and now you're saying Canada. So it seems to be one of those kind of general legends that's just about everywhere.
I assume they have a lot of common denominators, I think mine, at least where I grew up, it was uniquely tailored to the logging industry here.
Ours was along the Sabine River, you know, so that was what it was. It was about the supposed to happen around the river.
One last movie question. I already asked about the often way back then, and if you'd ever have hope. So, your latest, the series is taken from the earlier books in the Happy Land series, but Honky Tonk Samurai is what you're out actually promoting, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm promoting, sure.
What's the twist in Honky Tonk Samurai? How do you separate that?
Well, I don't want to give the twist away. That might ruin it, but what I will say is I call it a reunion novel. That means a lot of people from some of the other novels, and I'm not going to say all of them, but I will say Jim Bob Luke returns, and
awesome
Jason
character.
Statler is in there a little bit, and so I'm bringing in a lot of different characters from before, so it's kind of like the Magnificent Seven, but there aren't seven of them. But there are certainly people who have been prominent in previous books, you know.
I love Jim Bob Luke's performance, as you might call it in this one.
He's a character, yeah.
Well, when I started
Don
digging
Johnson
in, I
did such
I,
a good job of him on Cold in July. I thought Don Johnson nailed that character. You know, I have another book, The Thicket, that Peter Dinklage is trying to, get made. And if he does, I think that he's another one of those people like Don Johnson embodied Jim Bob. I think that Peter Dinklage embodies my character Shorty in The Thicket. So that's one I really do hope gets made.
Indeed. Hap, I get the feeling that a part of Hap is your alter ego. Do you get asked that a lot?
I don't know if alter ego is exactly right, but I do think that, I'd rather be me than him. But what I do think is that he's certainly inspired by my own life. I mean, I was a Vietnam War resistor, and I was very much into civil rights when that wasn't exactly popular. I had long hair and, the usual stuff that people were, you know, against in the 60s. A lot of the conservatives, guys with long hair, they're, you know, I never even smoked dope. I don't even drink. I'm one of those guys. Mine was mostly social, political, and artistic were my kinds of, I guess, rebellious moments. But Hap has that as his background, and I knew people somewhat like Leonard and some very much like Leonard, and I combined a number of characters to make him. But me, yeah, as the basis for the character, yes, but for being the character entirely, obviously not. And certainly, you know, I've never had any of the horrible things happen to me that happened to those two poor guys.
Well, no, you wouldn't have lived to tell about it. But
no,
you
wouldn't
have. It was, if it happens like the you know, just sort of the part of you, maybe the bolder you get to say some things that you wouldn't otherwise say. Does that mean Leonard is the antithesis, the eviler you, the guy that has no filter whatsoever? Because he really comes with no filter.
Well, you know, Hap says exactly what I do say. There's not much there that he says I don't say and won't say. But as far as Leonard is, I think, sort of the person who asks the questions that help you understand what you believe or how well you believe, because sometimes I think Leonard's side makes more sense in certain areas. But, you know, I'm much more of a liberal. I'm a social liberal for sure. I'm a, you know, fiscal moderate. I always say I'm a capitalist, but I'm a kind capitalist. I believe in a lot of social programs. In fact, most like Medicare and Social Security. And I come closer to being Bernie Sanders than I do Hillary Clinton. But even though I'm a capitalist and he's a socialist, because I'm, you know, in the social area, then I think I fit that way. But I think that Hap is one of those guys that had a lot of idealistic views and perhaps too idealistic, and then real life ran up against him. And I think he's a lot more pragmatic as he's getting older, but he still has that hope for a better mankind, even though he himself has fallen kind of in the pit along the way a little bit. And I think Leonard just says, hey, this is who I am, this is what I am, and I accept it. And I think that his views of conservatism or republicanism are more akin to like Eisenhower or, you know, the earlier Republicans. One of the things I have going for my guys is they don't age like I do. I mean, I may be the smarter one than Hap, but he gets to stay younger longer.
Yeah, him and Bart Simpson, frozen in time.
Yeah, that's right, frozen in time.
You know, speaking of the style and approach, you know, I asked actually Benjamin Whitmer when he was on the story. He quoted Dennis Lehane as his definition of noir. Now, I don't know if you really consider yourself noir when it comes to these kind of to your crime novels. I just consider them as crime fiction, the ones that are crime fiction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Lehane said, one could argue that noir is, however, a working-class tragedy. Aristotle, when he defined tragedy, mandated that the hero must fall from great heights, but Aristotle never imagined himself the kind of roadside motels James N. Cain would conjure up when he saw the smokestacks rise in the northern English industrial hell of Ted Lewis's Get Carter. And that's, you know, in other words, your guys, like that definition, are rooted in the underclass. There's no great fortunes being bought and sold. It's all backwoods and meth labs. And I'm wondering, is that an important feature?
Well,
to what you want to
achieve? It was an important feature that they're blue collar, because that's what I know, so I can write about that best. That doesn't mean I'll, you know, never write about anything else or haven't. But primarily, I've written about the blue collar guys, the poor guys. I grew up really poor. And so I've always felt that background worked for me. As far as noir, I never really try to have categories for my work. Are there certainly noirish influences? Yeah, there are, but they're sweaty and backwoods, and they're about a different thing. They're sort of the nuts in the country, the guys that have their little schemes and their big plans that, you know, that they want to rob the laundromat. They're not looking to rob a bank. They're looking to rob the laundromat, for example, or a firecracker stand. But to them, that's, that's the big time. And at least as far as a criminal enterprise goes. So to me, I don't really stop and think of it that way. I just say, okay, these are the people I'm writing about. They're criminals, but is it, noir or is it mystery? I don't really worry about that. Some of my books have more mystery elements than others, some of the Hap and Leonard, but I never really think of them strictly as mysteries or noir. I think crime covers it better than anything else, but it's not entirely that. And that's somewhat problematic because people want something that they can put in a box and that they can nail the lid on that box and know what it is. I think that's just how people are. And I think that it took a while for my work to catch on with a broader audience for that reason alone, is that I didn't know what the hell it was.
Well, for me, it makes it a lot more makes the plots palatable. There's something within reach. There's something realistic. Having been involved in some nefarious dealings in my life, it's easier to buy. You know, I'm the guy in the theater shouting out, "That could never happen." And you know, one of the things I find with your characters and books and the actions they take is things go wrong. You know, things don't always. You know, timing isn't always on. People, you know, they aim and they don't always hit what they're aiming at. And I think that's an important quality because it adds life.
Well, you know, there's also, you can have a story that has a fantastic construct, and you can accept a lot of fantasy and things that wouldn't happen in reality if you build that world properly. And if you do believable characters, people will accept a lot of different things. But one thing about the Happen Leonard novels they're more fun than some of my other novels, but they certainly have a dark side, and they certainly have a blue-collar side. And I've done a lot of things Hap's done. I've been in real fights. I've been in some bad situations. But, of course, theirs is multiplied by 100 because, they're adventure heroes as well. But I think when you write from the root of what you know, that even when you get a little farther out from reality, as you yourself have experienced it, maybe into even hyperbole, the thing is that it has that such roots in reality that other people find that they can catch on to that and that they can believe the other stuff as well.
Yeah, they can identify along the way.
Right.
Well, you know, I've only really read your crime stuff, although, different. There's a lot of variety in that itself. But you write into a couple different genres. And, I've even heard it said that you are your own genre. But, I was thinking about that comment. I saw it bandied about it a couple times in reviews or interviews. And I was thinking, it seems to me that the common denominator for a lot of your stuff, or at least the stuff that I've read, is it's in first person, and you're able to really capture the character of the narrator just by sticking with that voice, which is not an easy thing to do. Some people have a very loose definition for first person.
Yes.
Is that intentional by design, or is that something that just comes with instinct?
Well, for me, first person is the close, and I've written a lot of things in third person. In fact, one of my favorite books, Sunset and Sawdust, is written in third person, and I've written several books in third person. It's just that most of the time I write in first person because it's the closest to pure storytelling. It's the kind of story that I always liked, is when somebody's sitting on the porch and telling you something that happened to them. Or if I'm reading a book or a story and it's told in first person, and it's done well, because as it's always also been said, it's the easiest to do but the hardest to do well. And I believe that's true. And I've even told stories within stories within stories told by a first-person narrator. And it's more difficult than it seems, but for me it's a much more natural method because I come from a storytelling background, a storytelling culture. So for me to tell these stories in first person makes them more immediate. It's also a way for me to show that character's traits more personally. And even if you're very different from that person, I think a lot of times when it's told in first person, you find yourself falling into to that character's mindset. Even if you don't feel like you're that character, you seem to feel closer to what that character's saying. When I read James Cain's Double Indemnity and The Postman Rings twice, even though I never felt like I was connected with that character and doing what he was doing, I felt much closer to understanding and feeling what that character was doing because the first-person narration was just so brilliant. And so I've always tried to do my best to kind of hook readers into a natural story as if we're sitting on the back porch. And I say, the other day, let me tell you what happened to me. And then I just want to carry it from there.
The stuff that I it resonates most with me, I think, is, Cold in July, for instance, is there's the protagonist in that is an everyman. He's just a regular guy.
Yeah.
Working at the frame shop, and
right.
And he gets pulled into circumstances far beyond his control. Unlike, Happen Leonard, who are, knee deep in shit all the time. And I think that really spoke to me as a reader, as just someone enjoy getting pulled into something.
Right. I mean, the Happy Leonard are like tarnished knights with sweaty balls. You know, they're always out there trying to do something in the heat and the worst, you know, situations possible. But then you got Richard Dane in Cold in July, which a lot of the basis for that story is based on real life for us. Not, you know, obviously we didn't kill a burglar and all that, but we went out to buy a house. We were looking to buy a house, and we looked at one, and it had a bullet hole in the ceiling, and we thought, wow, how did that get there? And then I went home that night. I dreamed the entire novel in one night. I'd wake up all night and have sweaty and wash my face and just had a miserable night, but I had an entire novel, and that's never happened to me before. I've had short stories and I've had fragments, but this was an entire novel with nearly all the characters. When I started writing the novel, you know, some new characters appeared, but usually dreams don't make a lot of complete sense. But this, I think maybe because I kept waking up and going back to sleep, it did it in a chapter format, and it was a very strange, almost living nightmarish sort of novel, but it was based in real life too, because I'd seen that bullet hole. Karen and I, my wife, were raising our children, our son right then, before our daughter was born, and the mindset was when we just had one child. I think we had both were born at that time. But, you know, I knew what it was like, the frustration of wanting to be a good parent, the frustration of wanting to be a good father. And I grew up in a masculine culture, and I know how that's defined. And I thought, well, that would be interesting, is if this guy had lost his father early on. And some of this didn't come across in the film as strongly as I'd like, although I love the film. But in the book, you have this father connection to, you know, the older character, Ben Russell. And I think it was also as a guy who had never felt tested in his life in a physical way and in a masculine way. And he thought, you know, I'm going to do this because I'm also doing something that's for the good. And, of course, things don't always go as smooth as a person plans.
Yeah, or in the direction a person plans.
No, and sometimes the things that seem noble can turn ignoble pretty quick.
Yeah, that book had all the elements, that movie is, you know, I know it did well, but I still feel like it's underrated, and I trumpet it
to folks
who aren't familiar with it, to pull them in. Story ends where the story ends person, like, you know, if it's 75 pages, hey, it's a novella. If it's 275, it's a novel, do you set out to write things at certain lengths?
You know, what's funny is that pretty much a story ends where a story ends, but the truth of the matter is if I set out to write a novel, there's just sort of an inner clock inside of me that knows that there are certain ramifications and ideas and complications that need to develop, and they'll just find them. I don't really think about them. I don't plot stories. I go to bed at night, I get in the morning, and it's there. You know, and I write, and it's very rare that I write every day, just about 5 to 7 days a week. It's rare that I miss. Sometimes I have to for business reasons or personal reasons or something like that. But generally I'm 5 to 7 days a week, 3 to 5 pages a day, no less than that. Occasionally when I'm really cooking, I might get 10 or 15. But for me, it's about showing up, and I have a tremendous amount of confidence in what I do, not because I think it's absolutely correct. I know better than that. If you start to think you've got it right, then you've got it wrong. You know, you could constantly sort of reevaluating and learning new things. But I'm confident that I'm going to show up. I'm confident that I'm going to get work. I'm confident that most of the time it's going to turn out at least on some level that I don't fall below, and that sometimes it's going to go better than that. But I never try to compete against myself. I just try to write the story I'm writing at that time and just tell it as well as I can. And sometimes I can, you know, my best on that day is better than it was on another day and not as good as it was another time. So I'm always trying to do my best with the understanding that all I can do is as well as I can do. And so I never really get caught up in, you know, worrying about it or fretting about it or anything like that, because I have a lot of confidence from doing martial arts all my life, and even if you're not doing something physical in martial arts, or you're not, you know, it's not about whether you can whip somebody, but it's about having a confidence in self, and so I think that's very much affected the way I write and the way I work.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, when I was a young man, and I was interested in the kind of writers who had larger than life personalities, and they're really, you look at their track record. There's only a few books out there. But when I got older and I actually started writing, I realized that the guys who are heroes to me are guys like yourself, Elmore Leonard, James Lee Burke. We were talking about him earlier. Guys that, you know, the work ethic is there, where they just keep on coming, and it's about discipline more than anything, which is something I didn't realize when I was starry-eyed and young, you know?
It very much is. It's discipline. It's not a romantic profession. And you know, I think about, I don't really know Jim Burke. I just, of course, know who he is, but I know that from his history that he, you know, he just kept working. He had a period where he didn't sell a novel for, I don't remember, 12 or 15 years or something, but he kept doing it. And then there was Elmore Leonard, you know, he had some hard times too, but he just kept doing it. And I've had that too, and I've had to get up in the morning and you say, well, gee, I don't know if I've got enough money in the bank, or I don't know if I'm going to be able to get this done, or somebody's sick, whatever the problem is. And you sit down and you produce. You have to compartmentalize during that moment. And I've always said, if I'm having certain financial things I have to deal with, the only way to do it is to write my way out of it. I've been fortunate in that since the, you know, 90s, I haven't had a lot of financial, you know, woes, but I certainly had them when I was younger. And occasionally, you know, you have them even in the midst of your career, because sometimes a contract goes awry, or something you're working on doesn't pan out as, you know, the way you hoped. And so you may put it on a back burner after spending 2 or 3 months on it. And that happens now and again. Mostly I've been fortunate that it doesn't, but the important thing is when it does do that, you have to be able to sit down, put yourself in a mindset to get that work done, no matter what's going on around you.
At what point were you able to completely stop with the day job? Was it that you were confident enough to go on without another gig? Was it an accomplishment or a challenge?
Well, I sold my first piece in 1973, which was nonfiction, which is I sold all the nonfiction I wrote. I sold the first thing I wrote in nonfiction. But then when I switched over to fiction, it took me, I don't know, 2.5 years maybe, possibly three, I don't remember. But I started selling stories, and by 1981, I was full-time, and I had sold a couple of novels. I had enough money in the bank. My wife was still working at that time, so she said, you know, about to have kids, you can stay home with the kids, you can write. And so I did. I was a house dad, and I wrote in my spare time, which was less spare than you might think if you're raising children. And then when my career continued to go, when I wrote Cold in July, got picked up for film, I wrote a screenplay, I was writing comics back when comics were really paying a lot. And I was able to say, hey, if you want to quit, you can, because she did. She was a dispatcher at the fire and police department, and she was kind of worn out with it. She'd been there 10 years, and she wanted to go to work for me. And I said, if you do, I think we'll do even better. And that's exactly what happened. And so she's worked for me ever since. And that was about 1988 when she went to work for me. And I had some dark moments between 81 and 90 as far as finances, as far as like security and things like that. But once, I guess about 86 rolled around, that pretty much started going away. And by 88, and when she quit and went to work for me, it's been pretty solid ever since. So it's really, again, showing up.
Well, you're an American success story.
I'm one of those that does actually believe in the American dream. You know, I hear people say it doesn't exist anymore, and it's not as good as it once was. But it never was about being rich. It was about an opportunity, not a promise. And a promise is something that no one can give you. But the opportunity was to be able to make a decent living and put a roof over your head and things like that. And, you know, that's even gotten difficult. For people who work hard and do the best they can. But it was never an absolute. So in some ways, I always expected I would achieve it, and in other ways, I look back and think, damn, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah, roll the balls.
I never take it for granted.
Tom and Joe,
I need to
take a break. I just need to go ahead and make an announcement. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Office of the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. Joe, may I please ask a question? I know Tom is sure. our host. I listened to you on NPR and Terry Gross.
Right.
You told the best story, and you know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
You and your dog. Will you please repeat
yeah.
that story? Thank you. Thank
well,
you.
Yeah, I will. I was just telling this thing that happened to me when I was young. I was about 4 or 5, and I remembered
yeah.
it, you know, as I grew up. And I actually talked to my mother and helped fill in some of the little things that I had questions about. But when I was young, we lived on a hill that overlooked a honky-tonk. And beyond the honky-tonk was a highway, and beyond the highway was a drive-in theater. And about the only thing we had to do at night, because my dad was a mechanic and he was sometimes on the road, and back then, obviously, there were no cell phones, there was no internet, and we didn't even have a TV, which was, you know, probably a good thing at that time, because I read comics, my mother told me stories, and we sat at the window and looked out at that drive-in theater, and we could see the images, but of course we couldn't hear it, but my mother would
right.
make up stories, and so that helped in the storytelling. But my dad felt that I was alone too much, so he got me a puppy. And this puppy became my constant companion. You know, we were, like I've said before, like brothers. We would eat out of the same bowl when my mother wasn't looking. And so we'd wander all the way around the yard and stuff. And behind us on a hill even higher than where we were was another house. And it had a beautiful flower beds. And you had to cross a little creek to get over to his property. And one day my dog went over there, my puppy, and I followed him. And my dog started digging in the flower beds. And this guy, I don't know, I guess he looked out the window and saw it or whatever. All I remember is the door burst open. He comes out, grabs my dog by the hind legs and whacks him in the back of the head with a stick or a pipe, I'm uncertain what it was, and flipped him into that creek, into that ditch. And, of course, I'm devastated, and I run home, and I tell my mom. And my mom had to leave and walk to a phone because not everybody had phones back then. And so she had to find a neighbor with a phone. And the neighbor called and somehow got in touch with my dad. He must have been working close by at Wanda Petroleum then, I believe it was. Or no, I'm not sure, that wasn't it. But nonetheless, wherever he was working, she called. And I don't know how long it took, but I just remember seeing him drive up in this black car. Like I said, it was like Mr. Death showing up. And he got out of the car, and he walked over to me, and he said, "You stay here." And, of course, I didn't. I followed him up the hill. He knocked on that guy's door, and he opened the door, and my dad just hit him. Hit him just as hard as he could, knocked him flat smooth out. And if he didn't knock him out, that guy pretended he was knocked out because he knew that he had somehow aroused a grizzly bear. And my dad got that guy by the ankles and dragged him out of his doorway and slung him through those flowers back and forth until he had just about flattened that entire flower bed. And then he tossed him in that creek. And then he went down and found my dog, which was still alive, and took it back to the house and took care of it. And that dog died when I was, 17 years old. And so my dad was always my hero after that. And I also make a note that that guy moved away on the hill shortly thereafter, and I think that may have had something to do with it.
You know, Joe, I love that story more than life itself. I really do.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, when you look
mm-hmm.
back at that story, how did that
yeah.
affect how you wrote after that?
You know, I don't know if there's any of these in movies and books, there's always this one moment where people, you know, this is what made me so-and-so. But, you know, all the clues certainly seem to be there, even the drive-in theaters that I've written about and even the storytelling that my mother was telling me, although my father was a far better storyteller. But we told stories, and this thing with the dog was a bonding sort of thing. I guess the thing with my dad would have been like an early violent experience, though I've never felt bad that he did it. I've always felt happy that he did it, and I know there are people who would
right.
disagree with me on that, but you know, my feelings were, was here's a guy that was watching out for his son, watching out for his son's pet, and was taking care of a bully. And you know, I just never, you know, felt bad about that. But I think that many of the clues for what I write and for the kind of feelings I have in the work that I do, and you know, especially the largest majority of it, comes from
right.
that incident, as well as several others, and many of them having to do with my father. You know, my father had his weaknesses. He was a racist in the worst kind of way, but yet he made a point of being kind to everyone, and you know, he would when we hunt squirrels, we hunted them to eat. I've told this story before, too.
Yes.
But we would bring extra squirrels to the poor black families who were even worse off than we were, or we would bring extra fish to, you know, who my, the people that my dad knew. I've seen my dad stop in the rain with a black man with his car broken down and his family in the car and white people coming by honking at him as a joke. And he crawled under that car with the rain running over him and worked under the hood there, and not under the hood, but under the car, and was able to fix that guy's car and didn't charge him anything, didn't want anything for it. So I always judged him by what he did, not always by some of his rhetoric.
You know, Joe, when I listen to you talking about this, I listen to these stories, how much of the stories that you tell and how much of what you're writing is regional, or is it not?
I think that people, the way they treat one another, I don't know that it's all that regional. But I do think that there's a flavor that's regional. I think that's the difference. It's like, you know, it's like different martial arts. They're all martial arts, but they all have a different flavor. And I think that's the way it is, too, with storytelling. Southerners have a different way of telling a story. And I think poor Southerners, as opposed to rich Southerners or what they call middle-class Southerners, have a different background and have a different storytelling base. When I remember reading Robert Parker, and I always liked his Spencer novels and the others, but he was coming from somebody who really seemed to know about having money or knew about having a good education. And I could sense that in his work. And then in my work, for example, I think you see a blue-collar guy who's, you know, maybe learned some things over the years. I like to think so. But my roots of my stories are about people that are the underdog. And I've always thought it was odd that in the South there was such a problem with blacks and whites, because poor blacks and whites, we were very much the same. We were suffering the same problems, and we should have been unified. But it's like that the blacks and whites were pushed apart by people who had money, in a way. Because, you know, we were all really on the same level if we would just have enough sense to know it. And so I've always felt this kinship with the poor, be they black, be they white, be they Hispanic, be whatever, you know. And I grew up in a time when women didn't have the opportunities that they have now. And, I mean, that's hard to believe, but I remember when women were thought to keep their mouth shut, to do what their husband said. And, you know, my mother never did that. She wasn't going for that crap. But that's right. Another thing. I have a strong woman in my life, and my wife's a strong woman. Our daughter is a strong woman. So, you know, that's all wonderful. But when my mother did it, that was against the grain. And when she would say, one time I was at a theater and we saw black people going up a stairway that was on the outside to the cozy theater, and it led into the balcony. And I said, Mama, why are, and I was probably 5 or 6. I said, Mama, why did those people have to go up that back stairs? I remember telling me, he says, I can't explain it to you, but it's not right, and it's not always going to be that way. So she had just the opposite rhetoric of my father. But that was another defining moment, because those moments that you remember like that, there's certainly probably some that define you that you don't remember, but certainly there's half a dozen moments like that when I think it shaped the way I was going to be as a human being later on, for better or for worse, and I like to think mostly for better.
Wow. Well, those stories have a common denominator of a dichotomy of character. Your father, the two messages you got from your mother and growing up in East Texas, and it seems to me, you know, a lot gets made of Southern literature and the South, but it seems to me Texas itself is its own sort of entity, and you, are a representative of East Texas, right?
Yes,
you feel
East
that
Texas
way? You're an ambassador?
Well, I don't think of it so much that way, but I do believe that I represent it sometimes in a broader way, but nonetheless, I do represent it, and you just hit on something. My mother and father, in many ways, that's Happ and Leonard. Because that's the people who had this difference of opinion, but they stuck together. They worked through thick and thin. They took care of their family. You know, they were my heroes. But I do believe that East Texas has so much more in common with the South than it does with the rest of Texas. But yet it's not quite like the South either. It looks like the South. It's got trees. I saw somebody that did a review of Happ and Leonard in the San Antonio paper, and they were saying, well, these people don't know much about Texas. They filmed it in Louisiana, and I thought, whoa, they filmed it in Louisiana, but you don't know much about Texas because East Texas looks like that. And they were very careful to, I think, pick spots that looked exactly like East Texas. So I had no problem with that. I mean, there's maybe a little bit of difference in the geography. It's a little swampier there. It's a little hillier here. But it's a different region, and it has a different voice. My accent's not even the same as the rest of Texas. It's somewhere in between Texas. It's somewhere in between the South. But the culture is a mixture of Southern background, as well as that Southwestern touch, a little bit of Cajun, and a little bit of something that's just unique to Texas itself. And it's people who came here in the earlier days to hide out or to start over, and their descendants still have echoes of that kind of attitude. So to me, East Texas is a country unto itself.
There was a Talking Heads movie called True Stories back in the 80s, and it was set in Texas. And they had a way of explaining Texas that you just don't often hear. And it was David Byrne out there,
I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, it showed Texas as a group of innovators and free thinkers and a completely unique. It doesn't seem to get to that kind of rating from other folks in the country.
Well, yeah.
Do you still feel like you have that spirit?
Yeah, I certainly do. I mean, I'm like, obviously, you think of Texas being very conservative and very religious, and it certainly has a lot of that. But it also has just a lot of contrarians. And I think what a lot of people forget is that, the big cities in Texas voted for Obama, but it was all the rural that voted against. And so there's a bigger mixture than you think. It's sort of the way the place was gerrymandered as far as how the votes came out. But I do believe it's a more conservative state, and I think more, at least verbally, religious. A lot of the people who claim to be religious have never even read the Bible, and all they know is a few Bible quotes the preacher gave them. But nonetheless, it's a unique place. But again, I want to emphasize the fact that East Texas does not look like the rest of Texas, and its people are somewhat different. Even though there's people here with hats and boots, most people here don't look like that. Most people are farmers in their appearance, or they're blue collar people in their appearance. And even people that don't farm anymore still have that look, because this was a farm country, this part of Texas, East Texas. And it still is. And, of course, the people raise cattle, too. But it's just unique. It's very hard to explain, and I try to explain it through the characters in my books. It has a lot of individual, quirky people, and that's what I love about it. That's what makes it unique.
Yeah, it makes for a great tapestry. Listen,
yes.
we're coming in on the end. We were down for a few minutes, so we squeezed a couple minutes, extra minutes out of you, and you've been very patient with us. But I got a couple questions from some writers who wrote in, and
sure.
We'll release you to your duties. You and I and Joyce Carol Oates, us three, like a trifecta, are in a book that's coming out that put together by a guy named Eric Beener, who's a friend of mine and all around great guy. And the book is called Unloaded, and it's a collection of stories without guns. Essentially, is the concept behind it.
Right.
And so here's Eric's question. He said, maybe me, I could mention that Matt Collins has a love-hate relationship with guns.
Right.
Does that come from your own feelings about guns? Hap mentioned several times that he hates guns, yet he's a crack shot and will use them whenever needed.
Right. Well, part of it, too, is I'm writing crime novels, so I'm writing about flawed people. I'm writing about people who have used guns. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's what I'm suggesting in reality, but I think that it reflects a sort of Texas attitude, especially for liberal people like me, because I don't like guns, but I have a shotgun, and it was handed down to me. But I just don't think we need a ton of automatic weapons. I don't think we all need to go around armed. I don't think I don't think an armed society is a polite society. I think an armed society is a nervous society. But if you're writing crime novels, you're dealing with criminals, and even Happ and Leonard are criminals in their own way, so they're going to resort to criminal activity. And I think that's just going to show that, that's another way that people try to solve problems is, unfortunately, with guns. And criminals, that's even more so. Yeah.
Tom and Joe, we have a caller on. Erica
sure.
is 260. Hello, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
I'm Dan. It's Les Edgerton. How you doing, Tom?
Les Edgerton,
how you doing, Joe?
Who is one of the best
I'm doing good.
Noir crime fiction writers around.
Hi,
Les.
I didn't
go
hear
ahead.
You.
You're
Hi,
one of the best
I
crime fiction writers around.
I was listening to Joe talking about East Texas. That's where I grew up, too, but even different in East Texas. I grew up in the Brazos River where it empties into the Gulf, and he's a little
yeah, you're,
farther
you're,
north.
Well, that's what we call coastal Texas.
Yeah, and it's exactly
yeah.
like you say, but people tell me I was in Texas and I didn't like it or I liked it, and I said, well, what part were you at? And they say, and I said, well, you know, Texas is like a country. It's not like
yeah.
a little state like I'm in now, Indiana or somewhere. People are pretty much the same. You've got everything. In fact,
all right,
where
so
I got,
Les,
we,
tell us
we
your
don't
question,
consider,
baby. Tell us
yeah.
your question, love.
My question
tell
is
your question.
Is Casey made any appearance in Happen Lettered, or is her music featured
well, you know,
at all?
She has. She has. Her music
cool.
appears in the second episode, and we, both of us, appear in the background in an episode. And I'm not going to say which one because I have a contest going on for the person who first spots us in an episode.
Okay.
And she
I'll
has music in Cold in July, and she's got stuff coming out on the Animal Planet and a bunch of other things. So she's busy.
Well, she's a fantastic singer. And I don't
Thank
know
you.
Where she got her looks. I haven't seen your wife yet, but it must be from her.
It is from her. It is from her. Thank goodness.
So I hope to see you in May at WRW, Joe.
All right, man. Thank you. So
hey,
nice
Les,
to hear from
thanks
you.
For calling,
yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Les. Love you, baby.
Bye.
Yeah, he's a great
Bye-bye.
Writer. He's a fantastic
right,
writer.
Bye.
I think he's one of the best noir writers working today.
So, Joe, here I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You also, not only do you do noir crime fiction, but you do horror, right?
Right, a lot, yeah.
Tell me about it, baby, please.
Well, I think that probably when I first got my, I started out with crime fiction, I wrote crime fiction, but horror fiction is the first thing that really gave me any kind of name. And, you know, for what it's worth, I think I've won 10 or 11 Bram Stoker Awards and a lot of other different things like that. But mostly in my horror, with the exception of The Drive-In, maybe The Night Runners and Dead in the West, has been short stories and novellas. And I've written about 300 or 400 short pieces, counting articles and essays and stories. So that's where I got my reputation in horror, was mostly through short stories.
Well, I got a tie-in question with that, and from Maria DeMiles, author of the novella Route 12, and a very great Southern writer in her own right, is coming
okay.
up. Her question is: you're so good with short stories and with full-length work. Which do you enjoy writing? Not really aim to write, but what gives you more satisfaction?
Well, I can say I like it all, but the truth is I like short stories and novellas better than anything. I like the shorter works. Novellas have really become a favorite of mine because I'm able to do a lot that I can do with a novel, but I'm able to do it more briefly and more, I always think shorter work has more power. I never set out to stretch a novel. I write a novel to exactly the length it should be, but there's something about a novella that seems to be just right for telling certain kinds of stories, and they seem to be the kind of stories I like to write. And short stories give you the opportunity to do so many different kinds of stories. So that's why I've written about, 400 short pieces, of which a large part of that is short stories.
Yeah, the novellas, I agree, are lean and mean.
Yeah.
A good short is definitely an art form, but the novella's back. You know, they said that was a dead medium for a while, and it is back with a vengeance.
I made it early on with really short pieces, like 2-3 pages, and so I've done all the links. I like them all, you know.
An excellent author and a friend of mine who's also a bit of a hero of mine. I'm sure he'll be blushing to hear it. But Keith Rawson out in Phoenix, Arizona, wants to know if you plan on writing any more westerns.
Well, I've written several. The Magic Wagon, The Thicket, Paradise Sky. I certainly don't plan not to write any. I just don't know that I've got my plans that far ahead. When I wrote Paradise Sky, I reached a pinnacle in my career for myself of something I really wanted to write. So, but it's right now it seems like that the well is filling up again with new ideas and new things I want to do. And among them may well be a Western, but right now, no. And but yeah, I think in some ways I had such a draw towards Westerns and always have, and even the Happy Leonard novels in many ways are Westerns. But I believe Paradise Sky to be the best book I've ever written, and certainly the book I'm most proud of.
Wow, well that's high praise coming from yourself. I'll have to push it up the list a little bit.
Yeah.
And one last one, Brian Lindmuth, who's a publisher of Snubnose Press, which is my my initial publisher, the first guy who took a bite and took the risk of taking me on. He wanted to know if you'd ever considered writing a Happen Leonard novel from Leonard's perspective, and if so, how would that work?
You know, I have thought about it. Would it work? I don't know. The only way it wouldn't work is if I failed at it. You know, that character, even Jim Bob, people have asked me to write about, and Vanilla Ride, which I think might be the most likely one for me to do for some reason. But, yeah, I have thought about it, but I don't know if I could do it. Somehow, Hap's way of seeing the world has a lot to do with how Leonard is perceived by other people. And I don't know how it would be if I tried to invent it from Leonard's point of view. So I'm just not even sure I can do it, but I think about it, and I haven't ruled it out.
Good to know it's still on the menu, I will say.
Yeah.
And I do have one follow-up for all of it, once again,
sure.
From Eric Buechner, the man who put out Unloaded. I'll drop that again. It's out for pre-order now. You guys can pick it up, Unloaded. Find it on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. Eric
Absolutely.
Wants to know, you've gone so, he says, gleefully over the top in some novels. Do you
mm-hmm.
ever self-censor? And if you do self-censor, what is too far?
I do self-censor, but I don't know that I'm doing it. I'm aware that I've done it, but it isn't necessarily about being too far, because I never try to write something just to see how far I can go. I try to push the envelope in the sense of pushing the envelope into making a story be the right story and not just stick to certain restrictions because everyone else has. But by the same token, I don't try to say, I just got to see how far I can push this. But sometimes it goes pretty damn far. And for me, I don't really have a rule. I just have a feeling inside when I'm doing something. I say, I don't think I want to push that any farther. I think the story that I pushed the farthest was a short story called Drive-In Date. And I was trying to do that from the perspective of two serial killers who just didn't understand that there was something wrong with what they were doing. And they just have horrible sexist and criminous anything you name bad, they had it. But yet to them, they were just having a gleeful conversation about life and what their expectations are while they have a dead body in the backseat. And it had to do with necrophilia and all that. So that's probably the farthest that something of mine has gone. But when I was writing it, I wasn't thinking of it that way. And sometimes when you go far enough, you say, okay, I've done that. I don't need to keep going there. And on top of that, I think if you make your career in horror or crime as to trying to be the excessive one, after you've done it a few times, then it just becomes a one-trick pony. It all becomes unreal. When the reason it has power and passion is when it's done from that standpoint that you're trying to put people in that mindset, not necessarily to glorify that, but just to show that people have all these different sides, which is what writing is about. Sometimes you've done that and just say, okay, this is my calling card. No, it's like horror novelists who write, the gorgeous thing they can write, but it has no other element other than gore. There's nothing else there. The gore doesn't actually teach you anything about the characters or about the story. And then they feel that they've got to write every novel, every story like that, because that one might well have gotten some press or some attention. But you really got to not worry about that. You just got to let the story lead you where it goes naturally and write like everybody you know is dead. That's always my motto. Don't write for anybody but yourself, because otherwise you'll start repeating yourself or writing for friends or trying to write for the reviewers or the critics or to make other people happy, and you'll be unhappy and miserable and repetitious. So write for yourself. Write like everybody you know is dead. And then when you're done, just hope like hell people love it then. That's when you get to be the salesman and the happy writer, think, oh my God, I hope people like it. But when you're doing it, I don't think you should worry about that. I think you just got to write the story as it comes to you and as you feel it.
So you're the only critic you're worried about.
I'm the only critic I'm worried about. I mean, obviously, when I get through, I love it if the critics like it. But I've always, you know, there's somebody, I think it may have been Hemingway, said if you believe the good reviews, you got to believe the bad ones. And the way I look at it is a consensus, because I think that most people, that if they're giving you an honest review, and I don't mean the people that are just being jackasses, you know, there's always the asshole that wants to review you or who he thinks you are. But most people, I think, are given honest reviews. And if they hate my book, I think, well, you know what, that was their honest opinion. I can live with that. But if you get all bad reviews, you might be thinking, well, I'm certainly not hitting it out of the park. And if you get all good reviews, you can't really necessarily believe that everybody loves you, you know, that's ridiculous. So reviews are a tool, and, you know, there's something of a guide. I mean, if you're getting mostly good reviews, you might think, well, I might be doing something good. But if you start paying attention to that, then you start thinking, what did the reviewers want? What are they looking for? What was it that they liked? And then you start trying to write to them. You can't do that. Well, you can, but I think it's a horrible way to go. It is for me anyway. I don't want to do that. I want to write for me. I became a writer because as a kid I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to tell stories I liked. That's what I'm still trying to do.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I know it was a little bumpy during the first bit, and thank you for being patient through our technical difficulties.
That's all right. No problem.
And hopefully we'll edit them together and it'll be out as a podcast in a heartbeat.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, and good luck on the series. I know it's
thank you.
It already smells like a winner, and
I hope
and,
so.
And everybody out there, buy Honky Tonk Samurai. It's a fun ride as it sounds like. And once again, this is Skid Row Chatter, and y'all have a very good night.
Good night.
Bye bye.